Hi, I'm Mark Brody, co-host of The Show, one of KJZZ's original productions. It's a program with news and features from across Phoenix and the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode.
Good morning, and welcome to The Show on KJZZ 91.5. In Phoenix, I'm Sam Dingman. Coming up, The Messy Girl takes televisions by storm. And why you might want to think carefully about who has your personal information online and who they're selling it to. But first, the Dragon Bravo fire, sparked by lightning on July 4th, has decreased significantly in containment over the past few days. It's down to just 4% as the blaze pushes north with extreme fire behavior. Just 1 week ago, on July 22nd, the Dragon Bravo fire had reached 26% containment. But now it's grown from 13,662 acres burned to over 105,000. With us here to talk about the challenges facing fire crews is Stephen Pine. Pine is the author of Pyrocene Park, A Journey into the Fire History of Yosemite National Park. He's also a fire historian and emeritus professor at ASU. Stephen, we've heard so much debate about what should and shouldn't have happened in fighting this fire. Can you walk us through the thought process that officials rely on in dealing with situations like this?
Generally, fundamentally, the issue is trying to get the right fire on the land. And the two techniques we have for doing that basically are lighting fires and fighting fires. And those get more complicated than they might seem. They're not even a spectrum. We think, well, we have full control on one side and full burning on the other side. Actually, what the world is filled is with all kinds of hybrids and blurrings and mixes. And we're seeing with the Dragon Bravo fire, we're seeing a kind of serial reincarnation of this fire into different forms, and each of which is requiring, in a sense, a different response. And if you look at the aerial photographs from Bright Angel Point, the developed area, you see all these trees surviving very nicely and the structures incinerated. So this is a totally different kind of fire, a different dynamic. It transitioned from one to another. It is now a full bore wildfire. I used to work in the North Rim. I spent 15 seasons there on the fire crew, 12 as crew boss. And the area that they were trying to contain that fire in was known back in the day as the Iron Triangle. It was a term borrowed from the Vietnam War of that time. And this was the ugliest place on the North Rim to have to deal with fires. Very dense, mixed conifer forest, tons of dead and down fuel. It was just a nightmare to even walk through it. And the likelihood of them being able to hold it was slow. I think they had to try.
So when you say there's been a lot of fuel buildup, that means a growth of more trees, more vegetation in the area?
Yeah, it becomes denser. In this case, I don't know that there could be much more growth because it was already kind of overgrown and sort of paved with branches and fallen material. You've got more trees dying, more stuff coming down. There had not been a significant fire in that area since I left, and there probably hasn't been a significant fire in that area for 150 years. I don't know.
So,
but it's a really difficult place once it's going under these conditions. I mean, I think they were trying to draw to an inside straight, and I don't blame them for trying. They needed to try.
When you say draw to an inside straight, you mean they were sort of hoping that they would be able to get a perfect poker hand with their approach, and the odds were against them?
The odds are against them, but not impossible. I think they needed to try, particularly after the disaster of having the lodge and area burned. We can't just sort of walk away from the fire because the fire is not spreading like just a smooth tsunami, to use a current term now, but as this blizzard of sparks.
Mm-hmm. So to ask the obvious question here, Steve, would it have been smarter to try to completely put out the fire from the beginning rather than do this containment?
Well, in retrospect, yes. Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't think anybody wanted the outcome that actually happened.
So can I go back to what you were saying at the beginning about the difference between lighting fires and setting fires? Is the idea behind that that had more controlled burns been taking place in the region prior to the outbreak of this particular fire, the current situation wouldn't be as bad?
Well, I think that's the understanding, and the choice is really fighting fire, fire fighting, if you will, and fire lighting. Mm-hmm. And we think you do one or the other, but all large fires, as we've seen in this case, also involve massive amounts of fire lighting in an attempt to control the wildfire. At the same time, substituting some kind of controlled fire or prescribed fire is the preferred term, in advance of wildfire is a way of altering the environment, reducing fuels, rearranging fuels, creating an environment where the fires that do result, wildfires that do result, may not blow up. I mean, these forests are used to burning, and this is a naturally caused fire, so it's occurring under natural conditions, but the actual context now has been altered by a long period of fires removal. Well, that removal in the Southwest tends to begin with grazing, overgrazing sheep and cattle. And that occurs throughout the region 25, 30 years before the Forest Service is even created. So before any policy of fire exclusion was in place, it was already happening because of the character of ranching in the area. And then the agencies come in and continue a policy of excluding fire as much as possible. They saw fire as damaging. There were large damaging fires in the country. And we now recognize that was a mistake.
So let me just make sure I understand what you're unfolding there, Steve. If I'm hearing you right, because of the increase of ranching in the region, which obviously reduces vegetation because of grazing animals, there's a decrease in what you're referring to as fuel, plants and trees that can catch on fire. Then that coupled with the fact that there's skepticism about doing these, about lighting fires to control the population of fuel in the region, which has resulted in less prescribed burns over time, all of which has resulted in this kind of perfect storm of circumstances for an outbreak of fire like this to be very difficult to contain.
That's a lot of it. And also we have to add in global warming.
Okay.
So the conditions under which fires historically occurred on the Kaibab Plateau have really changed.
And just to be clear about the role of climate change in this, is it just that because it's raining less, the area is more dry and thereby more prone to burn?
Well, the pattern that really matters, and it's really distinctive in the Southwest, is the rhythm of wetting and drying. So it has to be wet enough to grow stuff to burn. Mm-hmm. And then it has to be dry enough for that stuff to actually combust. Uh-huh. And right now we've been in a roughly 30-year drought cycle, some of them quite massive. I'm presently in Alpine, Arizona, and I can hardly see anything green on the ground. And we're halfway through the monsoon. Where has the monsoon been? Where are the rains? So all the factors that are in play are tending right now to push us towards larger fires and longer fire seasons.
All right. Well, that is Stephen Pine, the author of Pyrocene Park, A Journey into the Fire History of Yosemite National Park, also a fire historian and emeritus professor at ASU. Stephen, thank you for this conversation.
You're welcome.
And now we revisit a conversation that we started to have yesterday, but which got interrupted due to a technical glitch. Last week, a Phoenix woman was sentenced to 8 years in prison for helping the North Korean government perpetrate a multi-million dollar identity theft scheme. Christina Chapman worked out of a nondescript home in Litchfield Park. If you were making a spy movie, it is probably the last place you would stage a sophisticated espionage operation. Matt Phillips reported on Chapman's unlikely story back in June for Sherwood News, and he joins me again this morning. Matt, hello again.
Hey, hello again.
Thank you for coming back to talk to us about this. So Christina Chapman was apparently doing all this from what the search warrant describes as a, quote, one-story single-family home with a tan and beige stucco exterior. When investigators raided this home, what did they find?
They found lots of laptops that were marked essentially to keep Chapman on target with all the jobs she needed to do to ensure that these foreign workers could continue to appear to be working in the United States.
So these laptops were basically enabling North Korean nationals to secretly work for major American companies?
Yes. The North Korean government has undertaken this program as part of a bunch of different means they use to raise money, largely to support their nuclear program, according to analysts. And this is one of the sort of lesser known ways that they do it.
And what exactly is the scheme? How does it work? What was Christina Chapman doing?
So essentially, there was a website that purported to connect U.S. employers with foreign workers. It was run out of Ukraine by a person who was subsequently arrested and extradited to the U.S. And he apparently knew that many of these foreign workers were actually ineligible to work in the United States. For instance, they were based in North Korea. So in order for these people to work for an American company, they have to appear to be in the United States.
Right.
And the way that they would do that was they would find partners within the United States, in this case, Ms. Chapman, and they would send the laptops. They would use her address, and the corporations would send the laptops to these supposedly remote workers within the United States to her house, and she would set them up and install the right software so that, and then she could link those laptops to the laptops in either North Korea or in Russia or in some areas of China where these workers are actually located.
So her house was basically like a portal to these workers, enabling them to work for these companies, even though they weren't supposed to be doing that.
That's right.
In the piece, you describe a little bit what a typical day for her might have been like, sort of running back and forth between laptops. Tell us a little bit about the kinds of situations she would find herself in.
Yeah, it didn't seem like the most glamorous job in the world. I mean, she was basically restarting computers a lot. You know, if a computer froze, she was ensuring that the proper software was installed. She would kind of often there were some indications that she would listen in to certain meetings to ensure that, like, she could respond to if there was a directive from, say, like an HR meeting as these people, as the North Korean workers were getting onboarded, that she could do it and make it appear that it was in the United States. There was requests to actually, like, go to corporate offices to pick up different ID cards and things like that. So it was sort of IT, kind of sounds fairly thankless IT work, but with an enormous amount of legal exposure.
And what do we know about what these North Korean employees were doing with this access that Christina Chapman was facilitating?
Well, that's the thing that's a little bit unusual about this. There's a number of different avenues by which the North Koreans use their kind of pretty significant tech talent to raise money. There's like Bitcoin scams and sort of computerized gambling scams that they're known for raising lots and lots of money through. These are sort of just people that actually do IT work by and large. Like, they will do some like animation, some website development. Like, they're competent, you know, IT workers, and they just basically collect an American paycheck, and then almost all of that is taken by the North Korean government. So it's not, it's unclear how much, you know, if there was malicious intent, you know, other than just to misrepresent who they were to do this work because they were ineligible to work in the United States.
Right.
But there is risk to the companies because there's some indication that sometimes once these people gain access to the computer systems of American corporations, they can then turn over that access to perhaps hackers or people who want to perhaps do a ransomware attack and things like that. So this is definitely something American companies do not want to be a regular occurrence on their systems.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. Well, that is Matt Phillips, reporter for Sherwood News, reporting on this very troubling scheme. Thank you, Matt.
Thank you.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Sam Dingman. Coming up, the distinct joy of drinking the perfect cup of coffee. But first, when most of us think of Tempe Beach Park, we think of the town lake. That's the center point of it all today. In 1999, city leaders dammed up the often dry Salt River and added water to create the lake, which is a major attraction today. But the park that surrounds it has been around for a whole lot longer than that, according to our next guest. Kathy Montgomery dug into the history of Tempe Beach Park in a recent piece for Arizona Highways titled Summers at the Beach and tapped into the nostalgia that surrounds the century-old gathering place. She spoke with my co-host, Lauren Gilger, more about it.
It started pretty small. It started with a pool. The residents of Tempe used to swim in the Salt River, but there were a lot of dangers associated with that. There was a rash of drownings. There was trash in the river that people could cut themselves on. So a group that was called the Civic Club, which became the Chamber of Commerce, had this idea, and especially Dr. Stroud was a member, and he really wanted to have a pool, an Olympic-sized pool. The state didn't have one, where amateur athletic union standards were met and sanctioned events could happen. And so the Civic Club just put together this plan, and they found this land where Tempe Beach Park is now. They had this idea to build a pool. And so that was the first thing, and that was the most important thing. And that's how it all started.
Right.
Then it got expanded over time. In the 30s, the WPA, the Works Progress Administration, got involved in doing a big expansion. Eventually, the land was expanded to what was then the Ash Avenue Bridge. And they just started building a lot of other facilities. They built a much nicer bathhouse. They built a bandstand. They built a multi-purpose athletic field and tennis courts. And there were just all sorts of things. There was a movie theater at one point. So it started very small, and then it grew and just became this incredibly popular regional attraction.
It also sounds like, Kathy, that it was a real center point for the community. Like, you have all these firsthand accounts from folks back then who talk about, you know, spending their entire summers there and the kinds of things they would do and getting out of the heat and the vibe of the place, I guess, for lack of a better word.
It was extremely popular. This story actually started with a much smaller story in Arizona Highways, just about the pool. Mm-hmm. And what I found when I was working on that story was just that there was this incredibly deep wave of nostalgia that I was tapping into. And people who grew up going to the pool, just, it was central to their lives. People would tell me that they would start early in the morning with swimming lessons. That was a big thing there in the pool. And then they would stay all day. And at the end of the day, they would swim all day. At the end of the day, that they would ride their bicycles home, and they would stop for a 5-cent root beer at Laird's on the way home. And it was just a really magical time. I did quote what one writer, Sally Cole, wrote, a beautiful memoir. She called it a collective memoir of the park. And I think she described it beautifully. She said, "It was a Charlie Brown world, an adult-free zone. The sun beat down on the city's children, the water shimmered, and the jukebox played its endless tunes, punctuated by the rattle of diving boards. Those of us who spent our youth there can call up those days from decades hence, can still smell the pool deck under our noses, can still feel the slap of a mist dive from the high board and that icy plunge."
Wow. That is a great quote. A Charlie Brown world. I love it.
Yeah.
But you write that by the 50s, really, the facility was getting old. Like, it was crumbling a little bit. The pool didn't have a filtration system, so it had to be drained every 3 days. You have this great detail that the lifeguard said they had to dive in and search for swimmers in the pool through all the silt before they drained it every couple of days. And yes. So they rebuilt it, right?
They did. Yes, it was quite an ordeal. By day three, you really couldn't see the bottom and all sorts of things were floating around in the water. It was pretty, pretty awful. So they did decide to modernize it. But in doing so, they made a lot of changes that just changed the whole character of the place. And most of those people that I talked about who just had this great nostalgia just really didn't like the results. So the Civic Club, later the Chamber of Commerce, had invested a lot of time in planting grass and cottonwood trees, and the bathhouse, which had been built by the Works Progress Administration out of cobblestone, was beloved. Mm-hmm. And so they replaced all that. They took out the trees and they took out the grass on sanitation grounds, I guess. Mm. They took down that beautiful cobblestone bathhouse, which had a lot of problems, to be fair, and they replaced it. They replaced it with this soaring kind of modern structure, which itself apparently was fairly significant architecturally. The pool was made smaller. People had to wear swimming caps. The diving boards were gone. A lot of the features that people really found charming and beloved just were removed. And so it just didn't feel the same to a lot of people.
What really struck me from reading your piece, it's that it seems to have always really reflected the times, right? Like, whether it was skating or softball, there was a bowling alley there once. You talk about love-ins in the 60s being there, right?
Yes, that is true. And one of the things that Sally Cole had written in her memoir was that in the 60s, when they made all those changes and the trees went away, she really felt the loss of that commons, that it really had been the center of the community for all those decades. And I'm not sure that it really regained that status again until after there was a Tempe Town Lake. And the city of Tempe really holds a lot of events there now.
Mm-hmm. You quote someone who talks about sort of trying to bring back the feeling that used to be there, right, when they developed Tempe Town Lake as it stands now. Do you think that that's been regained in some way?
That's hard. I think if you asked a lot of the people that I interviewed for this story, they would probably say it just has never been the same. Mm-hmm. But I think you were talking about Councilman Joe Spercalli. He was beloved by so many people, and he became a councilman. He was a councilman at the time that Tempe Town Lake was being planned. And he was sort of nostalgic, but also forward-looking. And he said, Tempe Beach was his salvation, he said, in the 11 years that he spent there as a lifeguard and a swim coach.
Yeah.
He talked about how on a Sunday, it was just wall-to-wall people. There were so many people there. And he said, we're going to bring it back. We really are. And so I think that was the vision. Mm-hmm. And I think to a degree, that is true that, you know, Tempe has really been able to make this a gathering place, but it is a different kind of a place for sure.
Yeah, absolutely. All right. Kathy Montgomery, contributor to Arizona Highways. The piece she wrote is called Summers at the Beach. Kathy, thank you so much for coming on to tell us about this. I love it. Thank you.
Thank you, Lauren.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Sam Dingman. When you visit pretty much any website, you are asked to accept the site's cookie policy. Cookies basically allow sites to use data to remember you for future visits. And they're just one example of the kind of data we all leave behind when we're online. Increasingly, it seems Americans are kind of resigned to the fact that some amount of our personal information is out there and that there's not really all that much we can do about it. A study from Pew Research Center done a couple years ago finds about 67% of respondents don't actually understand what companies are doing with their data, and more than 70% believe that even if they did have a better sense of it, they have no control over what either companies or the government do with their data. To talk more about this, our co-host Mark Brody spoke with Eileen Gua, senior reporter at MIT Technology Review, who's written about this issue. And they started with whether she has the sense that there's a feeling of resignation among people, that a lot of our data is out there and probably being used in ways that if we knew about it, we wouldn't be super thrilled about. But there's not really a whole lot we can do about it.
Yes, I do think there's a lot of wariness about our data, our privacy, and who has it. And it does not make my job very fun at times, because a lot of what I do is find out when there are more privacy violations than we knew about.
Well, so how right are we to be resigned about that? Like, how right are we that some amount of our personal data is out there in places maybe we would not like it to be?
I think we should be very worried about our data being out in all sorts of places. I don't know that we should be resigned. I think there are steps that we can take to protect ourselves. And there are also advocacy actions that we can take to try to fight for better data protection.
What kinds of things can we as individuals do?
Yeah, that is the question. I think, first of all, everyone has different risk profiles. So that's something to keep in mind. And I think one of the challenges is that people also think about privacy differently. You know, some folks are like, well, everything that I've got is fine for the entire world to know. And there are other people that perhaps because of the jobs that they do or their identities or different factors like that are rightly more concerned about privacy. So I think the steps that you can take from going through all of the privacy settings that are now on most phones, that's a basic, really thinking about what kind of smart devices you have in your homes. Mm. Yeah, just not accepting the standard settings, I would say is a really good starting point.
And in terms of policy, as you've reported, it seems as though right now, anyway, it's more of a state-by-state kind of thing than a federal overarching bill. I wonder if folks in the tech world think that's the right approach, or if it might be more effective to have a nationwide law as opposed to a state-by-state effort.
Yeah, I think the general consensus is actually that there should absolutely be a federal privacy bill. And there have been increasing efforts to get there, but it's really challenging. There's so many different actors that want different things. And Congress is going through some things right now. And really, so I think people don't expect that federal privacy bill is going to be coming anytime soon.
Do those state laws tend to be effective in doing what they are intending to do?
I think the state laws differ quite a bit between mm-hmm. them. But I do think that they are, first of all, maybe this is obvious, but they're better than not having the state laws there. I think the other thing that is noteworthy about state laws is that tech companies don't want to create and manage different, you know, services and different levels of privacy protection for 50 different states. And of course, we don't have 50 different privacy laws. But what that tends to mean is that they will often, you know, change their settings to make sure that they're compliant with the most privacy protecting law of the states. And so the great thing is that if California has a strong privacy protection, and it does, it's not perfect, but it's good, that also actually benefits the rest of the country.
So how prevalent is this issue in terms of the ability of tech companies to get and store and use data? And I ask because you go to most websites and there's some question about, you know, cookies or something. I mean, when I went to read one of your pieces on the MIT Technology Review, the website asked what you know, how I felt about, you know, the cookie policy that they were asking about. So it seems as though, like, you can't really do anything online without having your data at least somewhat exposed, if that's the right word.
Yeah, I think that's right. And I think the question kind of depends on what you mean by your data, right? Is it because data means so many things. Data is cookies on websites, as we're talking about right now. So that's what those privacy little click-throughs are asking for. But yeah. Data is also, there's metadata of the information, the photos that we upload, for example, to Instagram or to Facebook. I recently just published an article on how AI, some of the largest AI training sets have trained on massive amounts of user data of, you know, everything from photos to driver's licenses to resumes to everything that's been uploaded on the internet like 10, 15 years ago before we even knew that there was such a thing as, you know, like generative AI.
Yeah.
And so there's a lot of different types of data, and it depends on what kind we're talking about.
Well, it seems as though, and you alluded to this, and you obviously wrote about this, AI seems to have almost like supercharged this question a little bit, because in a sense, like, even if you are able to get some of your photos or other data off the internet somehow, once it's in the generative AI models, like, it's almost too late.
Yeah, that's right. What I had written about was some recent research that was just published that found that users who had, you know, uploaded like a resume or a driver's license or some kind of identity documents, sometimes just on a cloud hosting, you know, website with the idea that only the people that I share this with are going to be able to see it. That information is hard to access unless you have the link, but generative AI training sets use massive scraped data from across the web. And so when these scraping programs, what these scraping programs are able to get is very different from what humans are able to search for or perhaps access easily. And so what the research found was that there were cases where someone might upload to one specific website, but a web scraper then, you know, scraped that website, uploaded it to another hosting site. And so suddenly, even if you want to delete your data from that original site that you uploaded to, you can't, because it's in five other places, as well as these massive training sets that are being used to train AI. We were talking earlier about the role that state privacy law has on really all of us. But I think the other really important piece here is that there are really divergent paths that the United States is taking when compared to Europe, for example, which has just much stronger privacy protections. And what you're starting to see in Europe is just a lot more privacy protections that in the United States, we take a certain amount of our data being used as just the price of, you know, using these goods and services, these tech services. But I think Europe is really showing us that we don't have to take those data privacy violations as the standard. There is a better way.
All right. That is Eileen Gua, a senior reporter with MIT Technology Review. Eileen, thanks so much. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Mark.
At the end of the fourth episode of Lena Dunham's new Netflix series, Too Much, the main character, Jess, is shouting on the streets of London. She's standing outside her boss's house, where she and her boyfriend, Felix, have just attended a chaotic dinner party. The party devolved into drug-fueled chaos, which Jess gleefully participated in, while Felix spent most of the evening standing quietly in the corner. On the street, Jess is loudly proclaiming her worries that she and Felix, who've only been dating for about 10 days, are a bad match.
Oh my God. Too much, man. Much.
Maybe I'm not too much. Maybe you're just not enough.
No, I don't mean like, it's not an insult. I mean like, you know, you're too much. Like, it's a good thing. Like, just the right amount and then like a little bit more.
This moment, our next guest says, represents a major statement on the part of Too Much creator Lena Dunham about the types of female characters that can and should anchor TV shows. Joining me now is Amanda Kerberg, who studies and teaches digital culture at ASU. Amanda, good morning.
Good morning. I'm so happy to be here.
So tell us more about this moment and what you think it represents.
Oh, it's amazing, because I think we have, like, language obviously has evolved, and we should note, you know, is it even summer if we're not talking about an archetype of a girl who is in some way too much?
Right.
but we've always had these ways to describe a woman like Jess, or, you know, like Lena Dunham's Hannah from her seminal series Girls. someone is who is too much, who is a lot, who is extra, who is high maintenance, you know, who is trying to have it all in a way that just comes out sort of messy and chaotic. And so what I love about the way that we start into this series is that we get Meg Stalter's Jess as someone who's in love with Bronte heroines, and then and we're reminded that the woman who is too much in Bronte novels would have been in the attic, not actually having the romance with the main guy. So, like, she is pretty much the attic bride of Jane Eyre in the first episode when she takes out this candle because she's obsessing over her ex and her ex's new fiancé and accidentally lights herself in a very Bronte nightgown on fire. And if that isn't too much, I don't know what is.
Yeah. That actually, in the dialogue that precedes that clip we just played, you hear Felix, the boyfriend, saying, like, you know, the first night I met you, you set yourself on fire. Yeah. She has moved to London sort of on a whim without any, like, real clear plan.
Yeah.
She's just kind of careening through her life. And it struck me that she's the kind of character who, just to take it out of even the Dunham context, in a lot of shows would sort of be like the goofy sidekick, you know, the person who its other characters are sort of using as a way to bounce off of.
Absolutely, absolutely. So centering the plot around her as the protagonist is such a great choice, I think. And then having, again, putting her in a romantic context, too, because, of course, like, Girls, if we're going to use that again, you know, was so much about these characters centered around friendships among them. And so this is a kind of romantic arc with, yeah, the goofy sidekicks. You're right. The people who would set the kind of side tone for the main characters are now becoming the main character. And I think that also speaks very much to kind of the context of digital technology that we're seeing, too. She reminds me so much of this this moment in Girls where Lena Dunham's Hannah says that she's just lived her life chasing experiences over and over again, that she just wants to experience everything. Pretty much before we had the phrase do it for the gram or do it for the plot, that's right. What she's talking about, right?
Right.
And Meg Stalter's Jess is like that. She is just saying yes to everything in this sort of way that understands her role as being a kind of natural content creator, that everything's about experiencing things to share because everything needs to be about authenticity and transparency. So you go out, you do it all, you do too much, and then you share it online in some way.
Well, that element of it is very interesting because one of the central threads of the story does involve Instagram, right? Which is that Jess is following her ex and his new relationship with an influencer via Instagram, and she's constantly recording these monologues that one would normally post on stories. But she tells us these are actually just a way of her sort of keeping a journal.
Yes, which I love, too. The idea of taking the new technology but making it private again is such a great way to acknowledge the way that we kind of want to talk to ourselves now because it's what we're embedded in, but also kind of keeping it under lock and key to the degree that, you know, we can.
Right. Well, that's very interesting because if I'm following the plot correctly, at least in the first few episodes, she doesn't post these stories.
Yes.
It's just a way for her to sort of keep track of what she's feeling.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. I love that so much, the connection to the ex's new fiance, Wendy Jones, because she is sort of this archetype of the person that all of us see when we get online, right? This aspirational, you know, model, perfect person who probably knitted a whole outfit her first time picking up a pair of knitting needles. Just that person that all of us, we open our feed and we go, oh my gosh, I'm not that. Mm-hmm. I'm not that across all of these categories. So she not only has this aspirational perfect figure who she gets to watch on Instagram, but that person is the person who was recast into her life. Like, imagine that we all sort of have that now.
Yeah.
That when we're broken up with or we leave a job, the show continues and we were recast, but we can still watch the show.
Yeah,
that's disturbing.
Yes. Well, but, in this vein of attention and how we're sort of forced to have it, we have just about a minute left here. Mm-hmm. How do you feel this show fits into the general trend towards more of what is often called ambient TV, TV that's kind of on in the background? Do you think Dunham is trying to speak to that trend in this project?
I think so. And I think it being on Netflix is so interesting, too, because Netflix, of course, had Emily in Paris, which became the archetype of ambient TV, TV that is a screensaver while you scroll on your other screens or you do your hobbies or you do whatever. And this show is not that. This show is like bizarro Emily in Paris. Just in London, not background noise. You cannot turn away from it. And I think that speaks so much to the idea of how loud and overwhelming our lives are. That's where it goes beyond femininity. Like, we have information overload. We have everything in our lives that are too much. But that impacts all of us. We are all asked to be more roles than could possibly fit in a LinkedIn bio, let alone a gravestone. When we die, we will not become trees. We will become link trees.
Yeah. All right. Well, we'll have to leave it there. That is the show's pop culture expert, Amanda Kerberg. Amanda, thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Sam.
Good morning and welcome back to the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Sam Dingman. So at some point last year, I stepped out for mid-afternoon coffee. There was this small, dimly lit cafe across the street from my apartment building. Figured I'd wander in, check it out. When I got there, the barista, a dignified man with a salt and pepper beard and twinkling eyes, he looked me right in the eye. Before I could say anything, he says, "Can I make you the best cup of coffee you've ever had?" Now, who says no to that? I obviously said yes. As I watched him begin moving around deliberately behind the counter, he started telling me this story about the man in Costa Rica who grew the coffee that he was grinding. He placed a filter in a brewing cradle, moistened it with hot water, and filled it with the grounds. And he began painstakingly pouring water through the grounds, telling me more about this coffee grower and his farm, what the trees there looked like, and how the air smelled in the morning. After maybe 10 minutes, he finally poured the coffee into the cup, and he handed it to me. I took a sip. Son of a gun. Best cup of coffee I had ever tasted. I remember stepping out into the afternoon sun feeling like I had just come back from a vacation. The only bad thing about this experience is that I forgot to ask the barista's name, and when I went back to the cafe, he wasn't there. So I resigned myself to dreaming about that perfect cup. Until one day, when a friend sent me an email saying he had just had a fantastic cup of coffee and suggested that I interview the man who'd made it, Ron Cortez. So I Googled Ron, and there was the dignified man with the salt and pepper beard. Ron, it turns out, is the founder of Cortez Coffee, a coffee roaster based here in the Valley. And so I did invite Ron to come on and talk coffee. When we sat down in the studio, he said, quote, "Let's have a jam session." And that's what we did. I began by asking him a simple question. How did you make that amazing cup of coffee?
You have to go back in time. You have to imagine yourself, teenager, growing in Costa Rica, picking beans, thinking, what these millions of cherries that I'm picking, then they're juicy, then they slip through my fingers, good for? Then later you find out, now they go into a process of getting strip of the fruit, get the seeds, wash them or ferment it, dry them in the sun, put them in a bag, and ship them to the United States. That's what we're doing. We're picking beans. Well, imagine then you go forward in time 40-some years, and you find yourself being the one that is brewing those beans, having faith that you will remember them first, and two, represent the legacy of how many other people then did exactly the same. What an honor.
So that's what's important to you about that moment, is that you are the end of a very long process.
Yes.
Uh-huh. Yes. And that what you're putting in that cup isn't just a cup of coffee. It's the culmination of something.
If I don't put attention to the last step of that, you will not remember it. It was just another cup of coffee. It's just another. It's so everywhere. It's in every Circle K. It's in every little corner of the universe. What would make it special?
And what is special to you about a really good cup of coffee for you?
Memorability. You're drinking that cup of coffee and you're thinking, I wish I had more. It's a special moment. Mm-hmm. And I don't know how to explain it. It's not an origin. It's not a rose. It's not that. Is intentionality is, I am celebrating life by drinking this cup of coffee.
So you're making me think about, do you know the television writer Brian Koppelman? Mm-hmm. You ever heard of him? Yeah. He made the show Billions. And he does this thing where he calls the first cup of coffee every morning the Royale.
The Royale is a great name for
because
a drink.
He wants to put a halo around it.
The most memorable way to describe coffee gives you the will to live. So very short and simple, mm-hmm. but I made a practice in the morning not to make any serious decisions about my life until I go through the process of resetting, serving me a cup of coffee, then know that my psyche is going to be in a good place, and I've been there before, it's rooted, it's recognizable. Mm-hmm. That's how I start the day. Yeah. So why not put a halo on it? And why not make it a ceremony mm-hmm. where you're being sorting all the things and are laying around and think about it as a Catholic mass. You are in the process of doing communion. I think coffee has that intention.
Let me ask you, Ron. I mean, so far in this conversation, we've been talking about a very mindful, I'll say slow, considered form of coffee consumption, which I'm sure you know is out of step with the way most Americans drink their coffee. Is that difficult? How do you navigate that?
Yes, is a reflection of our culture. We're fast, fast, fast. How is jazz coming along with that? How is it you guys can keep throughout the years knowing then the youth are not jazz prone? We face the same challenge. Quality over quantity. And it pushes to be better and better. Otherwise, we lose our battle. So polish ourselves. Learn as much as you can. Invent. Come up with new things is what we do. And I would not have it any other way. It's what I got. And if you stick to one thing, you eventually become better than a sommelier. You become a sommelier of your own taste, which is very important.
You know, the way you talk about coffee, Ron, it's almost like you're talking about that it's not just a drink, it's like a way of understanding yourself.
Yes.
One of the other reasons I was so struck by how much time you spent with me that time that I came in to have a cup of coffee that day is that I did not have the sense in talking with you that you were worried that by spending so much time with me, you might not be able to get another person in there and make them a cup of coffee. How do you think about that piece of it?
Well, I feel very good. Time is so important to me. Then when you give me the attention of what I've been practicing for my whole entire life, it's a gift. Like when you drink it and you smile, you think positive about it, it's a gift.
Yeah, the way you're describing it, it's almost like you're saying that what I did is sort of tantamount to going into a musician's studio and saying, play me a song you wrote.
Yes.
This is going to be like kind of a maybe weird question, but I wanted to ask you, we have a bag here of your coffee. This is the Pura Vida.
Yes.
Roast. How do you come up with the names?
The Pura Vida is easy. Pura Vida is a lifestyle. It's the way that a Costa Rican will say hello, goodbye, how you doing? It's like it's a multi-use phrase. It means pure life. Huh. So, you want to be reminded of that. I mean, pura vida okay. is a great thing, man. Like, it's a great expression. So, the philosophy on coffee is whatever you remember. Like one of the things about Cortez is like, oh, there's no hidden secrets. Mm-hmm. I flunked it. I put all the stuff that I do to my coffee, hoping that someday someone who's getting in the business will start thinking, huh, look at this. This guy's doing this stuff, the little riddles that are there for the future.
Huh. So
it's artistry.
What's one of the little riddles here?
You look in the back.
Okay.
The thing says that it's air roasted.
Yes. Vintage air roasted.
Yes. Well, how I learned to roast was putting coffee in a popcorn popper. An Orville Redenbacher basic $2.99 on with Goodwill. It's an air roaster, and we still do it, not with the popcorn popper, but we have a giant air roaster, and that's what we do. Huh. Because we find out that the flavor of coffee improves if you remove particulars from the coffee you're roasting as you tumble it.
Right. here again, you're invoking this idea of there's a connection between you and the process. And it's more than that. It's about getting in touch with something deeper.
Well, it goes back to the roots of a little Costa Rican boy who was picking beans, who maybe at that time said, what would I give to end up being the one who received these beans and serving to the customers in a different land? Just think about it. It's how weird, how unlikely from the picker end up being at the other end and become a coffee scientist. It's an honor. It's an honor, right? When you have that much, you cannot be anything but generous. Pass it along. It's a motivational chemical, coffee.
Well, Ron Cortez is the founder of Cortez Coffee right here in Tempe. Ron, thank you for this conversation.
Thank you.
Well, we hope today's show gave you, if not the will to live, at least some fuel for the rest of your day. And like a sloppily poured cup of coffee, we always have more than we can fit in our hour-long container. That's why we have our newsletter, Radioheads. Head to kjzz.org and sign up so you can read today's issue. Thank you as always for listening. We will be right back here tomorrow morning. Hope you'll join us again. For Mark Brody and Lauren Gilger, I'm Sam Dingman. Talk to you then.
That's it for this episode of The Show podcast. To find out more about the stories from today or other episodes, visit theshow.kjzz.org. And you can subscribe to KJZZ's The Show on your favorite podcasting site. I'm Mark Brody. Thanks for listening today.